This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The postman only rings 5 times a week. Why do we need prime numbers anyway? And a little bit of Freakonomics Radio coming up on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 6th of February. Good as always to have you with us. The long-suffering and all but bankrupt United States Postal Service said today that starting in August, no more letters in home mailboxes. On Saturdays, the USPS figures to save $2 billion a year doing that. And you could make a case that most of what shows up in the mail you just don't want anyway. But Marketplace's Sally Herships reports 237 years of post office history is not easily undone.
The post office is losing $25 million a day delivering our mail. So what is in mail these days? I looked in my mailbox.
Junk. Some bank statements.
Mostly what's called first-class mail. John Callen is a postal industry analyst.
And that you would think of primarily as billing statements and people, if they're still paying, checks in the mail.
Greeting cards, that sort of thing. Callen says deliveries of first-class envelopes have been declining, and with that, the Postal Service's revenues. Junk mail, or what the industry calls standard or advertising mail, makes up half of the mail's volume but brings in much less money. And even junk mail is declining. You can expect 3% less this year. So does this mean we might one day lose our mail service altogether?
Well, I actually do not think so.
Rick Geddes teaches in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell, and he says he's not basing that statement just on raw optimism.
But on the experience in other countries that have made their postal services more commercial, more like real companies, more entrepreneurial and more innovative.
Like UPS and FedEx, private sector examples of speed and efficiency. But even these companies rely on the Postal Service for some of their deliveries. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Today makes it 100 days even since Hurricane Sandy slammed into the Northeast. And a lot of New Yorkers and New Jerseyites still don't have permanent homes to return to. So they're staying wherever they can find a bed, hotels, rentals, or crashing with friends and family. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on that enduring housing challenge.
Instant relocation is hard enough. Try doing it with 4 kids and number 5 on the way.
It's hard for them. It's a lot of work.
That's the situation Jennifer Dady and her family are in. Their Queens home is heavily damaged and under repair. They've bounced around, staying with family and friends. They finally found a rental in the Rockaways near their house.
It's helpful that I'm close. The kids can stay in their school, so that's good. You know, I can keep an eye on my house. It's easier. It's definitely easier.
She's moving into a newly renovated building. Ron Molis is the developer. He has a deal with the city to provide priority access to displaced people. Interest is strong, unlike apartments he offered elsewhere, like the Bronx.
I don't think we had any takers outside the affected areas, which was a little bit of a surprise.
Sandy's victims want it to stay close to home, where their family, friends, and schools are. FEMA's Mike Byrne leads Sandy Relief here. A native New Yorker, he understands those ties.
These neighborhoods are the center of their family life, their cultural life. In many cases, it's where people speak their language. We have 25 different languages we have to translate our material into.
Not to mention that New York's a dense urban area where many lack cars. You can move just a mile and be a world away. As for Jennifer Dady in Queens, she wants her family back in their home before her next child is born. Her due date is July. She's not optimistic. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It was a long, slow climb back to break even today on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a new record holder in a quirky and curious corner of the math world. The biggest prime number known to man has been discovered. It's got 17 million digits in it, and it was found, if that's the right word, by Professor Curtis Cooper at the University of Central Missouri. Professor, good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you, Kai.
So do mathematicians just invent this stuff so they have something to do? I mean, why do you need this?
Well, for the real large stuff, like the ones that we're looking at, There's really no practical application for finding that big one.
It's just fun to have.
I sometimes think of it as kind of an art form where the number is or like a big thing to discover, like climbing Mount Everest or landing on the moon something like that. And in a lot of ways, mathematics and art are pretty closely related.
Yeah, and both of which have their own merits, right?
Yes, that's right. I agree.
Now, this thing is 17 million some odd digits long. Have you read it all the way to the end?
No, I haven't.
What is that? I think that's cheating.
Yes. They have some websites that have all the digits out there, and I had looked at the first digits and the last digits, but on the website, unless you want to download like a 7 megabyte file, it has a big gap that says, and 300,000 lines later, and then they have the last ones.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I can tell you the first digit is a 5 and the last digit is a 1, but in between, I'm not sure.
Curtis Cooper, he is a mathematician at the University of Central Missouri, and he has discovered the world's largest known prime number. We've got it on our website if you want to see it. Dr. Cooper, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
More than one in four households in this country, 28% of them to be exact, are what finance types call either unbanked or underbanked, meaning they don't have a bank account or have to use bank alternatives like check cashers or payday lenders. So imagine that for a minute. No bank account, no credit card. Most online purchases would be out or at the very least inconvenient. Paying your rent or getting a loan for a car, really complicated. All of which is what you might call a business opportunity. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Tracy Samuelson reports.
Deborah Hopper does most of her banking during cigarette breaks at work. But today she's in her living room in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And it already, you can't see it. But you can see that it has a log of all of my transactions on my phone. So
is this like an app or?
No, it's not an app. It's just text.
And it's not a bank account she's checking. She gets her paychecks from the power company where she works, direct deposited onto a prepaid debit card. Hopper says she ruined her credit as a teenager and wants to improve it before she opens a bank account. Until recently, she was paying her $5.50 a month rent with money orders. That meant going to Walmart or a cash checking place and then mailing it in and waiting for it to clear. But since December, she's used a service called Pay Near Me. It allows her to swipe a debit card in a store and send money to her landlord.
I know that my rent or my payment is getting processed immediately, so I don't have to worry about slow mail, it being rerouted. I know they're going to get it by the time I leave the store.
And Pay Near Me does more than just rent. People can pay cash for things from car loans to Greyhound bus tickets at 9,000 different 7-Elevens or Ace Cash Express, a cash checking store.
It's as though we lent the point of sale terminal at the 7-Eleven store to some other business.
Danny Shader is the company's CEO.
So that other business suddenly had thousands and thousands of cash registers in the community where they could do business with consumers.
So let's test it out.
Do you have a Pay Near Me?
What?
It's called Pay Near Me. It's so people can pay cash for some of their bills.
Oh, no, we don't have it. Like, what kind of bill you want to pay, like?
I go to three different 7-Elevens that are supposed to have the Pay Near Me system. All of them give me a blank stare when I ask about it. But at least two of them, I figure out, actually do use it. They just don't know what it's called. And when I tell Shader, the CEO, about this little snafu, he says...
And that's exactly what should happen.
Shader says the clerks don't have to understand it. For them, it's like any other purchase. Here's how it actually works. Pay Near Me signs up companies like Deborah Hopper's landlord, and then the company gives Deborah and their other customers a barcode or a card with a magnetic strip that they can take with them to, say, the local 7-Eleven. There, the clerk scans it and takes the customer's money just like they were buying soda or candy. But the money actually goes to the landlord, the lender, Greyhound, whatever. The customer might pay a fee, a few dollars. That's shared between Pay Near Me and the 7-Eleven. Shader says it's usually less than a walk-up bill payer or money orders.
We're seeing a tremendous amount of innovation in this market because people are recognizing that there's an opportunity.
Jennifer Tesher is the president of the nonprofit Center for Financial Services Information. She says Pay Near Me is one of a bunch of new companies developing products for the unbanked, a good thing. But she worries that the services tend to solve one problem at a time, a way to buy stuff or pay bills or send money to family. So consumers need a lot of these different services.
They're having to knit them together and try to create a financial identity for themselves and hope that it's recognized when they might find themselves needing more traditional credit or needing to interact with a more mainstream player.
In other words, a whole slew of a la carte services might not help the unbanked get ahead in life long term. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Monopoly, as I'm sure you've heard by now, has a new playing piece. The cat, for some reason, is in. Businesses took note of the online contest to pick it and to pick one of the old ones to toss. A footwear company and a garden toolmaker launched campaigns to protect the shoe and the wheelbarrow. Pity, though, the poor iron, which just does not get a whole lot of consumer product love nowadays. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Simon Doonan, creative ambassador for Barney's New York, reacted to the loss of the iron token from Monopoly with
a terrible, dull, sinking feeling of shock and horror.
He notes that the iron was the old-fashioned 19th century kind you heated on a stove, which became anachronistic decades ago. These days, most Americans don't use irons like we once did. More fabrics are wrinkle-free. And the notion of business casual has been taken to extremes. People wear yoga pants and sweats in public.
It's perfectly okay and perfectly groovy to wear a nice button-down shirt that is very creased.
Mom, are you listening? I'm not a slob in my wrinkled pants. I'm groovy. But Doonan says the iron is still an essential tool in high fashion.
In the creation of design and in every couture salon, the iron is like almost like a religious symbol.
Speaking of religious symbols, you can still count on most hotel rooms to have a Bible in the bedside drawer and an iron in the closet. Harvard Business School retail historian Nancy Kane says the number of irons in hotel rooms has increased in the last 10 years.
Because hotel rooms, particularly large chains, have spent a lot of energy and money in the last 5 years trying to make hotel rooms much more comfortable and amenable to women business travelers.
Kane says the market for iron manufacturers is better in the United Kingdom, where the average woman spends 55 minutes a week ironing. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
all that education, all that experience, all those IQ points, all that Yale Law School degree, it doesn't protect you from having a false memory.
Wait, where am I again? Oh, yeah, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials eked out a gain of 7 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 13,986. The NASDAQ gave back 3 points, about a 10%, finished at 3,168. The S&P 500 basically flat, ended things at 1,512. On a day of little change, there were some big gainers. Zynga rose 9% today after reporting a small quarterly profit. Analysts had predicted a loss. A day before New York Fashion Week opens, Ralph Lauren, somebody help me out, impressed investors with its earnings. The clothing maker shares added nearly 6%. You think I know mine now, right? Time Warner Cable spun money out of those monthly fees. We all love to gripe about it. Shares gained 4% today. Bond prices, why, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.96%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary fourth quarter productivity and costs report. It's Fashion Week in New York. Take a bite out of the Big Apple. On second thought, don't eat anything. You have to fit into that fall line. And NASA holds a teleconference about an asteroid it says will pass close but safely by Earth. Maybe there'll be a run on deep impact rentals. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. And we have arrived at the part of the broadcast where big oil and environmentalism come together. They do so in the person of Sally Jewell, once a petroleum engineer, always a conservationist, currently the CEO of REI, the outdoor equipment retailer, and quite possibly the next Secretary of the Interior. President Obama made the nomination this afternoon.
She knows that there's no contradiction between being good stewards of the land and our economic progress, that in fact those two things need to go hand in hand.
We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer how a Secretary Jewell might do that.
Sally Jewell once spent a month climbing mountains in Antarctica. Thomas Kiernan is one of her climbing companions and head of the National Parks Conservation Association. Jewell serves on the association's board. Kiernan says he learned a lot about her character during a harrowing climb up Mount Rainier.
And that was a great example in my mind of her judgment. We could handle a little wind, we could handle some snow, a little bit of hail, but lightning, that's over the top, and we need to back down.
Jewell's experience with rocky terrain would come in handy at the Interior Department. Oil and natural gas companies are clamoring to drill more on public lands, which environmentalists want left untouched. But she's got street cred with both sides. Bob Irvin is president of American Rivers. He likes Jewell's conservation credentials and the fact that she's chief executive of REI. Irvin was just in an REI store a few months ago.
Oh, I bought us a new sleeping pad for camping.
Irvin says Jewell realized a clean environment was essential for REI's bottom line.
She has experience as the leader of a company that depends on a healthy environment for its profitability.
But energy producers also like Jewell's experience. Kathleen Scamma is with the Western Energy Alliance, a trade group for independent oil and gas companies. She points out that Jewell once worked as a petroleum engineer.
We're hoping she understands that oil and natural gas development can be done in a very environmentally protective way.
Scamma says she's cautiously optimistic about Jewell's nomination. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's do a little planning now for your summer, shall we? Beyonce launches her U.S. tour June the 28th. As it happens, she's kicking it off right down the street from us at the Staples Center here in Los Angeles, the busiest concert venue in the country. Seats go on sale this Monday exclusively through a new ticket platform known as Axis, which is owned, as it happens, by AEG, the same company that owns Staples Center. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The Beyonce ticket sale will be a big test for the Axis system. Thousands of people will log onto the site all at once, and very few companies outside Ticketmaster have been able to pull that off. Agata Kaczkanowska is a senior analyst at Ibis World. She calls the gamble
a no-brainer for them because it'll boost their income.
According to Ibis World, Ticketmaster sold about 150 million tickets last year. 20 million of those were at AEG venues. So with its own platform, AEG would get to keep ticket fees on those 20 million tickets, and it would have more control over prices.
And on the flip side, if talent is deciding between several venues, AEG can make a more competitive offer for them.
Most smaller venue owners avoid using Ticketmaster, which is known for its high fees, but not all of them.
This is Barbara.
Hi, Barbara. This is David from Marketplace.
Yes. Hold on for just one moment for me.
Sure.
Barbara Wiggins is the executive director of the Topeka Performing Arts Center in Topeka, Kansas. The 2,500-seat venue has an exclusive contract with Ticketmaster.
I'm sorry about that. It's like all the lines rung all at the same time.
Wiggins says that the advantage to using Ticketmaster is the massive amount of data the company has collected over the years.
Well, if we're selling a touring Broadway show and Ticketmaster already has a database for people that are typically theater buyers in the region, then we're able to have access to that information.
Of course, Ticketmaster's massive size also means it's slower to innovate. This is where AEG hopes to capitalize. One of the features of Access allows customers to control their entire concert-going experience, from purchasing a ticket to buying snacks at the concession window. So you could pre-order a pretzel and a soda and have it waiting for you at your seat. That way, you won't miss a minute of Beyonce. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks, Kai. I've been thinking about you, actually, lately.
Really?
I've been reminiscing. I was thinking about the very first radio piece that you and I did together back at Yankee Stadium.
Oh, Yankee Stadium, yeah.
You remember? Let me take you back here,
all right.
Kai.
So here we are, and this is great, and I'm having a good time, but the game doesn't start for like an hour and a half. Why are we at batting practice?
So you remember that, Kai, yes?
I do, yes.
You remember we were watching batting practice, and we saw A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, hitting all those massive home runs into the bleachers? You
shocking now, huh? Yeah.
Well, Kai, it's funny you remember that, because, in fact, it did not happen.
I was there.
We did not see A-Rod. We were there. We did not see A-Rod hit any home runs. But you did just beautifully illustrate the topic of our conversation today, which is false memory. Thank you very much for playing.
Anytime. I'm glad to help. Please continue.
Now, I got to thinking about this topic during all the Roundup interviews that Hillary Clinton has been doing recently, reminiscing about, you know, she's had a very eventful term as Secretary of State. And I was reminded of another Hillary Clinton reminiscence that turned out to be a bit off. Kai, I'm interested to know if you remember this piece of tape.
I remember landing under sniper fire.
Oh, yeah.
It was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles. To get to our base.
Yeah, and the thing was, there was no sniper fire, right?
That's exactly right. Hillary Clinton later said that she misspoke or maybe misremembered. So to speak about misremembering, here is Elizabeth Loftus.
Okay.
What I love about this example is that it shows you that all that education, all that experience, all those IQ points, that Yale Law School degree, it doesn't protect you from having a false memory.
So, Kai, Loftus is a psych professor at UC Irvine. She's a leading scholar in memory generally and false memory in particular. So recently, she and a couple of colleagues, along with Slate, the online magazine completed a study. And this study was huge, 5,000 participants. And they looked into how well we people generally remember political events, okay?
Right.
So what they would do is the researchers would show people photographs of various political events, but the gimmick was that each participant would see four photographs, three of them real, and then one that was doctored, okay? So for instance, George Bush hanging out at his ranch with his buddy Roger Clemens during Hurricane Katrina, which did not happen.
No.
Or they'd see a picture of Barack Obama in a nice friendly handshake with President Ahmadinejad of Iran, which also never happened.
Yep.
But Kai, here's the amazing thing. About half the participants in this study said that they did remember the thing that never happened. Okay, here's Elizabeth Loftus again.
many individuals wrote in details that expanded upon just the claim. I remember seeing this photograph. I remember seeing this photograph of President Obama shaking the hand of the president of Iran. And they may even tell you something about the feelings they remember having at the time they saw that photograph for the first time. But of course, they couldn't have ever seen it before because it was completely made up with Photoshop.
That's crazy, man.
It is crazy. Honestly, it gets crazier, and the crazier part okay. speaks to how partisan we are, yeah. our country. And I'm not just talking about the politicians, but the rest of us too. So what Loftus and her colleagues did, they did a follow-up study, and they found that Democrats and Republicans remembered different fake events very differently, which is to say, a Democratic voter was much more likely to think that the picture of Bush and Roger Clemens was real, and similarly, or you know, conversely, a Republican was more likely to believe that Obama had really shaken hands with Ahmadinejad.
And one wonders why Washington is in the state it is in, right?
It's depressing. I mean, you could say that we do a lot of it on purpose, but you could also argue based on this that maybe a lot of it is just the way we're hardwired to root for our teams. I will tell you this.
Yeah.
The research also suggests that there may be a way to improve, however, this gridlock in Washington, as long as you're willing to engage in a little bit of trickery. What I'm thinking, Kai, is this.
Washington never.
How about this? A nice doctored photograph. You and I could put this together of President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner shooting skeet together, I'm thinking.
We totally could.
Or how about the two of them at a ball game in Yankee Stadium, just like you and I
just
were
like
there,
you
although,
and me, man.
You know. The more I think about it, the less sure I am that you and I were actually ever at Yankee Stadium at all.
I was there, dude. I was there. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. That was pretty cool.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks for having me.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping make professionals and businesses look their best in search results and online review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today ripped from my Twitter timeline. We learned this morning former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is in talks for a book contract. So, Twitter being Twitter, there was a flood of possible titles for what actually could turn out to be a pretty good read. So here you go. Crime and No Punishment was one suggestion. Midnight in the Garden of Goldman and Evil was another. Tuesdays with Moral Hazard, or my favorite from Ben White at Politico, The World According to TARP, which I thought was pretty clever. Send us yours. We're at Marketplace APM on Twitter. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow picked up 7 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ gave back 3 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500, well, we'll call that flats. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.